Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
Now on view at Skadfesh, Manish Arora's Life is Beautiful. Renowned for dazzling designs in a rainbow of colors, Manish Arora has brought the talent and craftsmanship of India's rich sartorial history to the global forefront, earning international acclaim on runways across three continents. Designing in India since the 1990s, Arora's glittering garments celebrate extravagant expressions of self through varied materials, techniques, and silhouettes in a triumphant union of Western and Eastern aesthetics adapted to today's multicultural society with a touch of humor. Find out more at skadfesh.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for listening. The 4th annual Beltline After Dark Festival returns this weekend and features a variety of music, including Afrobeat, Motown, Soul, and Hip Hop. The celebration will also host art vendors, acrobats, pop-up performances, and a bike fest hosted by radio personality Big Tigger. We'll hear more about the festival later this hour as City Lights senior producer Kim Drobes joins Miranda Kyle, the arts and culture program manager for the Atlanta Beltline, along with musician Mosiki Scales, founder of the Common Ground Collective. Plus, our series, Speaking of Yollywood, features makeup artist Carol Rashid. She'll also talk about the writer's strike. And today, June 1st, begins Pride Month. Out Down South is an outdoor exhibition celebrating Atlanta's LGBTQ+ history through portraiture and oral histories told with local queer heroes' own voices. And the show is on view through October at the National Center for Civil and Human Rights. Co-producers Rachel Garbus and Samuel Landis join me now via Zoom. Welcome to City Lights.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, we're so excited to be here.
Well, what inspired you to create this show centered around storytelling from Atlanta's LGBTQ history?
I'm a little bit of a history nerd myself. And, you know, when I first came out, you know, I feel like I looked for everything queer and LGBTQ that I could consume to really kind of help inform who I was. Because, you know, growing up, we aren't, you know, especially here in the South, I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, and I know that I wasn't taught any LGBTQ history in school. And I found this amazing podcast called Making Gay History, which is Eric Marcus. He recorded all these amazing oral histories to inform a book that he was writing a couple decades ago. And then when podcasts became a thing, he started re-releasing these oral histories as podcast episodes. And these were just so moving to me, and they made me laugh, often made me cry, and just made me feel so connected to this community that I felt like I knew so little about. And so I was formerly at the National Center for Civil and Human Rights. And around the time that I started as a designer at the center, I got to work on a project with Julie Rode, who is one of the folks that we do show in the exhibit. And I got to work on a project with her where the center at the time was thinking about possibly acquiring the AIDS quilt and the Names Project. And so I worked on a proposal with her, and it just was such an amazing experience because I had been learning about the AIDS quilt and learning about AIDS and Cleve Jones, and now to meet this person who like had worked with Cleve Jones and had taken care of the quilt, and to find out that it had lived here in Atlanta and I didn't even know about it, I just was kind of dumbfounded that it just opened my world to see that we have our own history here in Atlanta, our own LGBTQ history. And so it's really my relationship with Julie Rhode that kind of got the idea rolling for me. Is I went to a panel that she spoke on, and I just was like, I wish I could make all my friends like come and sit down here and listen to these stories, because I think that they're so important, not only just to know our history, but to find a source of strength and resilience. As you said in your intro, you know, we're still facing, you know, the world is not perfectly equal just because we have marriage equality. And, you know, we still need to find sources of strength as we continue the fight for equality and equity. And so another friend of ours, who's actually the person that connected us, another Rachel, she came to me with the idea of doing an exhibit. And it's really all I needed to get me started, because I had been thinking on this for a while. I just needed the impetus of somebody else coming to me and saying that they would do it with me. And so that's what really got us started. She then connected me with Rachel Garbus, which has been amazing, because Rachel Garbus does oral history work and has that background in journalism that I don't have. And so Rachel and I have gotten to really work together, you know, these past couple years on, you know, I bring my curiosity for history and experience with design and work in creative fields, and Rachel brings her journalism and oral history experience. And together we've gotten to create this really beautiful project where we have both the exhibit and as well as a podcast.
Will you describe the outdoor space that hosts the exhibition and how visitors may interact with it?
Absolutely. So it's out actually outside. So I definitely encourage you to buy a ticket, go into the center, because there's a lot of other beautiful exhibits in there. And if you haven't been, I especially encourage you to. But the beautiful thing about this exhibit is it's actually accessible and free to the public, whether or not you go into the center. It's outside around the fountain that you can see if you're driving by Ivan Allen. If you're downtown around the World of Coke or Aquarium, you can drive by and you see these stanchions that are outside around the fountain. And in each stanchion, we have these beautiful portraits that have been taken of these, our honored subjects, as we call them, who are people who have had a role in furthering LGBTQ culture or rights, or have had an impact on our community somehow. So people from Kim Jackson, the first out lesbian state senator, to Julie Rhode, as I mentioned before, to Monica Helms, who is the creator of the trans flag, who lives up in Marietta, which most people don't realize. And so you have these beautiful portraits, and then beside them, you have a QR code that you can scan and listen to a little snippet of their oral history. So we've selected a story for each of the folks from the oral history that we did with them that you can listen to. So it's a really beautiful interactive experience where you get to see a beautiful photo of them, but also get to hear a little bit from them in their own voice.
Rachel, would you talk about the role of oral history in Out Down South?
Yeah, I'd love to, Lois. As Sam said, I came in with the oral history background, and I'm also a journalist, so I love stories. I've just, everything that I do is just touches on people's stories in some way, because I just can't get enough of them. So one thing about oral history, you know, it's this incredible primary source material we have for understanding how people experienced history. And as Sam mentioned, there's so much LGBTQ plus history in the South that often goes overlooked, sometimes because people in power have not cared to share those stories or have not even known that they existed. So you just have these incredible treasures of stories, and oral history is a really amazing way of gathering them. But what can be frustrating is that so many oral histories get recorded and then they get archived. And while they're very well preserved by amazing archivists all over the Southeast and all over the country, we have amazing archivists here, they so often just exist in an archive and don't have an opportunity to be shared. So what really drew me to this project was the opportunity to really bring those oral histories out from an archive and present them to the public in an accessible way. So each oral history is quite long, you know, they range anywhere from 2 hours. You know, if you're really going to sit down and take a whole oral history of a person's life, you could go multiple days, sessions, 6, 8, 10 hours. But we really pulled from these oral histories, some of which we did and some of which already existed in archives around the city, and transcribed them, listened to the whole thing, and pulled out about somewhere between a minute and a half to sometimes 3 to 4 minutes of a single story, edited very lightly just to make sure that people could really understand the context of where it was coming from and really engage with it while they're there. And because of these QR codes, people are able to do that on their smartphones, which I think creates this really amazing opportunity for people to just stumble across this exhibit, scan a QR code out of curiosity, and then hear this story told in somebody's own words, which, you know, as you all also, I think, share my love of stories, hearing somebody tell a story from their own life in their own words with their own dialect and their own way of remembering, I think is so powerful. And it really creates a completely different way of engaging with history. So I thought that what we created here was an opportunity both to showcase these amazing portraits, these beautiful visuals done by LGBTQ plus artists, connected with these stories that really touch deeply on people's personal lives.
On City Lights, we recently had a conversation with Grant Henry, the owner of Sister Louisa's Church of the Living Room and Ping Pong Emporium.
Yes.
And one thing that stood out in our conversation with Grant was his lifelong deep investigation of religious faith. He's a former seminary student who never became a minister, but nevertheless considers his bar, irreverent though the aesthetics may be, he considers it a kind of church, a safe space for everyone to come and experience community. How have others featured in this exhibition similarly grappled with religion?
That's one of the really beautiful threads that I have found with this project, is that faith is an element that really is so important in so many of the lives of the folks that we interviewed and just that we've included in the project. So, you know, we've included Rabbi Lesser, who is an openly gay rabbi here in the city. Of course, Senator Jackson, who I mentioned before, is also a reverend, an ordained minister within the Episcopal Church. And she also serves, I believe, with the Church of the Holy Ground, I believe is the name, and where she ministers to the unhoused community here in Atlanta. So it's been really beautiful. I think that that is a really special, unique thing about this project taking place in the South, is that so many, whether these are folks that have lived and grown up in the South or are transplants here, faith is so often a connection point, I think, for Southerners. And that comes out in a lot of these stories, is their own, you know, investigation of the faith that maybe they grew up with and the faith that they have now. And so that's one of my favorite parts, as, you know, I grew up very conservative and Christian, and that has been a part of my own journey of investigating what I believe now. And so I've found it to be really beautiful in the stories of the other folks that we've included in the project.
I had a quick thought about that, because yeah, I love what you said about that, Sam, and the ways that that's particular to the South. It's reminding me of, in our oral history with Rabbi Lesser, he talked about the ways that in the South, marginalized communities, be they Black communities, Jewish communities, queer communities, have really understood innately that they can't survive separately, that part of advocating for one group means building coalitions with each other. And that's something that Southern marginalized communities have always really understood innately. And I think that really comes through in a lot of these individual stories, where there's been so much coalition building and faith has been a really grounding part of that. So I think that does help tell this really specific part of this Southern story. And also the fact that, you know, when you're thinking about who to interview and how to showcase these stories, some of these people are very well known already. So we wanted to highlight, you know, people who haven't had an opportunity to showcase those stories, but also people who are using their positions of power to really hold those doors open wide for people to come through and have a voice and share in that power. I think that was really important to us in selecting who we interviewed here.
Oh, and it's so heartening. If you are just joining us, This is City Lights on WABE. I'm Lois Reitzes discussing the National Center for Civil and Human Rights exhibition Out Down South with co-curators Rachel Garbus and Samuel Landis. Another notable figure featured in your exhibition is Dee Dee Shambly, the first Black trans woman to be honored at the White House. Will you share her story with us?
Yeah, I did. I was honored to sit down for an oral history with Dee Dee. Really, truly one of the most meaningful and memorable experiences of my life as an oral history maker, but also as a person. Dee Dee has had a truly incredible life, and she is just such an example of a person who never stopped pushing those doors open. And once they were open, keeping them wide for other people to come through. She came out as a trans girl in her teens in a place and time where that was extremely dangerous to do so. She suffered so much horrific violence and mistreatment by the police and being, you know, thrown into prison for doing sex work, which was the only thing she could do to survive at the time. And then being housed with men because the criminal justice system didn't respect her gender identity, to surviving HIV/AIDS when so many people around her were dying. Just the way she describes it, you can't even imagine the horror of that time living in the middle of it. And she really thought she was going to die, but she didn't. She's been living with HIV as a survivor for many decades now, and she's really become an advocate for trans women of color, for the HIV/AIDS community. La Gender Inc. is her nonprofit that really started as a mutual aid organization. I think it's a really powerful example of people who really came together when there were no other services available to them and just really built an organization based completely on what does our community need? How can I help my sisters? How can I help my neighbors? And has really built it into this really successful, thriving organization. And she has a big community of trans women of color, some of whom are her daughters. She's really created a space for them where they feel safe and empowered and has really been a mother to them. And yeah, I believe it was 2008, the Obamas invited her to the White House. And it's really an amazing story. You'll hear it on the podcast. She's our first episode. The first time she came, it was very poorly organized and she did not feel like they treated her very well. So she called the White House and told them so. She said, this was, you know, not what I expected. And they were like, oh my goodness, Ms. Shambly, we're so sorry. And they brought her back along with a few other people that they had invited. And just, she had a completely different experience. So she tells that story way better. You'll have to hear it on the podcast when it comes out. It's really funny. She is really something else.
One more reason to love the Obamas.
Absolutely.
Or their staff, whoever it was who realized the error. You mentioned Monica Helms, Sam, the creator of the now instantly recognizable trans pride flag with its blue, pink, and white stripes. Monica became a trans activist after years of service in the Navy as a nuclear submarine tech. I'm eager to hear more about her journey from an overwhelmingly conventional male environment to her transition and role advocating for trans rights.
Yeah, I mean, she is one of those people that, you know, when I found out again that she was living up in Marietta and she had created this flag that has become this symbol of hope. And for so many people, like you said, it's instantly recognizable anywhere. And, you know, I loved getting to sit down and record her oral history. It's actually one of the first that I got to do with Rachel's help. And she talks about how she was living in Arizona at the time. And I believe it kind of stemmed from when she met the creator of, I believe it was the bisexual flag. And there was this conversation where she was kind of encouraged, like, why don't trans people have a flag? And why don't I just make that? And I just love that it came from like, as simply as that, just like, this doesn't exist and it should exist. So I'm gonna do it. And she tells in her oral history, which you'll get to hear a little bit in, if you go check out the exhibit, or if you listen to her episode when the podcast episode comes out, her experience of getting it printed and then, you know, it going to, I believe the first Pride that it was shown at was in Arizona. And then just like how she began seeing it pop up all over the country and the rest of the, even pictures of it around the world, which I just can't imagine, you know, the pride and that feeling of, you know, creating something that you put down on paper and all of a sudden you're seeing people hold it up, you know, around the country and around the world, and seeing that it brings so much hope to so many people, especially a community that is so, you know, has often been forgotten even by the LGBTQ community. And we I think are doing a lot of work in recent years to correct that, but trans people have been at the forefront of this fight for so long. If going back to Marsha and the gay liberation movement in New York, and it's beautiful to see them finally getting to take their rightful place of honor for all the work that they've done to pave the way for us and to stay in the fight. Like, you know, Rachel just shared about Dee Dee, you know, these are both women who are active still now in the community and continuing to do work for the trans community.
The portraits on display are striking and beautifully captured by different photographers. How did you source these?
Well, thank you so much, Lois. I also think it came out so well, and it was really fun to have all these different photographers because each one met individually with the subject that they photographed. So they really together created their own, you know, they picked the place, they picked the design. So each one brings out sort of a different thing. One of our great partners is Wussy Mag, which is like a local queer kind of niche culture magazine. I'm the culture editor there, and John Dean, who I think maybe you've talked to John.
Yeah.
Yeah. We love John. He is the editor in chief there, and he knows everybody. I mean, I've never met a better event producer in my life. John, thank you for all that you do. He's been really amazing partner for us here at this project. So, and he knows a lot of photographers. He's a photographer himself. So he helped connect us with some. Sam, I believe some of these were your friends. Some of these were my friends. It was once we realized that this was how we wanted to do this, to assign a different photographer for each subject, it was just such an exciting opportunity to both give work to our queer artist friends, who I always want to support and highlight, and just a really awesome opportunity to figure out who to connect with whom. I connected my friend Karen Shacham, who's one of our photographers, with Lorraine Fontana, who's an amazing organizer, just really tireless supporter of all kinds of marginalized causes. And I just knew the two of them would hit it off. And they ended up getting dinner after their photo shoot because they were having such a great time just to talk some more. So that was a really beautiful thing that came about from this.
Co-producers Rachel Garbus and Samuel Landis. The Out Down South exhibition is on view at the National Center for Civil and Human Rights through October. More information is on our website, wabe.org/citylights. In a moment, details on this weekend's Beltline After Dark Festival. Amplifying Atlanta, this is WABE.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Support for WABE comes from 100 Miles, a nonprofit committed to preserving Georgia's 100-mile coast. Protecting this critical coastal ecosystem takes all of us. Watch the stories of the innovators and future leaders who help keep our coast flowing at OurGeorgiaCoast.org.
This is City Lights on WABE. I'm Lois Wrights. It's great to have you along. The 4th annual Beltline After Dark Festival returns this weekend, June 2nd through 4th. and features a variety of music, including Afrobeat, Motown, soul, and hip-hop. This celebration will also host art vendors, acrobats, pop-up performances, and a bike fest hosted by radio personality Big Tigger. Miranda Kyle is the arts and culture program manager for the Atlanta Beltline, and she recently joined City Light senior producer Kim Drobes, along with musician Mossiki Scales, founder of the Common Ground Collective. Kyle began by explaining how the event got started.
It actually came out of a brainstorming session that we had with several of our artists who worked with us over the years, because we have such a diversity of performance artists and musicians, and we were trying to construct a way to really get people to explore new spaces on the Beltline that they may not have visited before and immerse themselves in new performance arts or music that they may not have experienced before. And we knew that Atlanta was such a festival town that the biggest appeal would be to really umbrella it under this idea of a festival or a music festival or performance festival on the Beltline. And so came forth, you know, Beltline After Dark, which really celebrates the incredible range of performative arts and music that we see in Atlanta and the region.
That's fantastic. So you mentioned that you were aiming to get people to explore different parts of the Beltline. Has the location changed year after year?
So in the beginning, we had it pretty much all over the West Side Trail. And then during COVID, we went virtual. And since COVID, we have consolidated to celebrating the last 2 years at Westside Park, or what most people know as the former Bellwood Quarry. And so once we feel like there is more understanding and engagement and participation, we'll begin to broaden out again in future years and activate more spaces along the corridor. But right now we're really excited about celebrating this new and magnificent park on the west side that kind of feels like a hidden gem. And we really want people to come and explore the park and see how gorgeous it is and plan their events there. And so we're really using this as a way of celebrating our incredible spaces on the west side.
Oh, that's wonderful. And how was the artist lineup selected this year?
So every year we have an open call for artists, musicians, and performers. And we worked with Mossiki Scales and the Common Ground Collective because they are a longtime performance and creative organization that we've collaborated with since almost the very beginning of Art on the Beltline. We trust Mossiki's vision for arts and for culture and curation. And so we came together, and No Tables and No Chairs, which is his brainchild, and I'll let him, he'll talk about that more in a minute, kind of engulfs our second day of Beltline After Dark and becomes this incredible immersive experience. And we have cultivated the first day to really be a celebration of our musicians and performance artists as well. So there's a lot of collaboration and crossover, but the artists come to us through that process of our open call that we have every single year, which is open right now until June 13th. So if you are a musician and performance artist and want to participate next year, you got to apply right now.
Oh, wow. You're doing it a whole year ahead, huh?
Yeah. It takes a lot of planning.
Well, Mossiki, let's talk about No Tables, No Chairs. What is that aspect of the event?
Well, No Tables, No Chairs is a celebration of African diasporan culture. And so it's a convergence where we have some of the energy of the historically Black colleges and universities, that style of marching band music with New Orleans Second Line. We also collaborate with the group called Atlanta Junk Canoe Group, which hail from Nassau, Bahamas.
all the beaten air we call our very own. Hand in hand, soul to soul, we will make do. Like a phoenix from the ashes and the beat of junk new. Nassau Rock and Nassau Roll. Grab a holler rock.
And so they bring that carnival festival here. We also have Lillian Blades, who is also from the Bahamas, who's a visual artist, and she's responsible for some of the head pieces and the shoulder pieces. And so we celebrate motive culture, this idea of movement, and what better place to engage people in movement than on the Atlanta Beltline. So we have the visual display, the musical display, and again, to engage folks around moving, walking, dancing. We have a parade, we have a concert, and we seek to energize the Atlanta community. And this year, we have an additional musician, Asan Koyate, from West Africa, who will be engaging in West African dance and music. And so it's we're having a celebration of life here, just energy, positive energy.
Oh, that's lovely. And I love that phrase, mode of culture.
Yes.
How did you come up with the name No Tables, No Chairs?
Kind of out of the tradition. Growing up in, I grew up in Gary, Indiana, and both of my parents were a product of the Great Migration from the South. And when I'd go to, let's say, a Southern revival at my grandmother's church, when it got to a certain point, it's just energy. No one's sitting down. So I have a song called No Tables, No Chairs. And my experiences in West Africa, I noticed the same thing. It just seems like once we get to a particular point in the music that there's movement, right? No one's pulling up to a table. No one's pulling up to a chair. Talk that talk so you can talk it again. Walk that walk so you can walk it again. No tables.
No tables, no chairs.
Walk that talk so you can talk it again. Walk that walk so you can walk it again. No tables.
No tables, no chairs. Yeah.
And again, back to the concept of motive, this idea of movement. I recently saw a video of James Brown teaching dance moves. And in the African and African-American tradition, there's a tendency to dance the music, even dance the song. So he's saying, this is the boogaloo, and here's the dance that goes with it. Here's the camel walk and the funky chicken. And so it grows out of that tradition of movement and dance and engagement.
Masiki, is there any other performer that's on the bill this year that, as a fellow performer, you're super excited about seeing?
Absolutely. San Koyate, looking forward to seeing. I've seen videos. I've talked to Miranda about his work, and I'm really looking forward to seeing his work, as well as the visual artist that we've added in Kamau Dorma, who will be creating an African-Brazilian shaker instrument as a part of our crafts table. And that shaker is it's a wicker shaker that has a calabash as the bottom. And so young and old, we get to come and make instruments that we can actually use in the parade. And we're having pre-workshops as well where these instruments are being created.
Miranda, we were talking about West Side Park. How close is the Beltline to becoming connected to West Side Park?
You know, I love this question because it allows me to drive people to our website. Our Vice President of Design and Construction, Kim Wilson, has done a really brilliant job creating these maps that are color-coded and they have timelines attached to them. So you can find your neighborhood, you can find where the Beltline is closest to you, and it gives you a timeline about whether that section of the Beltline is under construction, whether it is in design, or whether the ribbon cutting is coming up soon and you should attend because now you've got the Beltline in your backyard. So I would encourage people to go to the website and click on it because we have so many projects under construction right now. I don't want to tell you a wrong timeline. So I would definitely recommend going and checking it out, and you can click on it and see where it's at in the process.
That makes sense. Nobody wants to misspeak about something so exciting. But what do you consider the significance of the Beltline connection to Westside Park to be when it does come to pass?
Well, I think, you know, the original vision for the Beltline has always been parks, trails, transit, public art, and culture, right? Where we want to connect our formerly disconnected city that was, you know, broken apart by the highway system and bring the neighborhoods back together. We want to make sure there's green spaces and parks accessible to everyone in this city. And we want to make sure our communities and, you know, our neighbors are immersed in public art and culture that feels like them and feels like home. And so having Westside Park come online and being a part of its evolution is essential to that vision. And particularly working with Mizuki Scales and knowing that Mizuki has this deep, deep knowledge. I'm pretty sure Mizuki can play any instrument you hand him.
Miranda, I can't play every single instrument, but thank you for having so much faith in me.
Listen, my favorite memory is one of the first times we did a trail walk, and he's just like, have you ever seen this before? And it was this really cool, like, guitar thing, but little, I don't remember what it was called. But it was also like a mute, a wind right. instrument. I don't know.
Melodica, yes.
There you go. And I was like, this man can play anything. You could probably invent an instrument and hand it to him and he'd figure out how to play it. And so we knew that as we open up and explore new spaces in our cities or invite people to these spaces and parks in our cities, it was vital that we have such a adept and wise cultural curator like Mizuki partnering with us to make these projects happen.
Oh, that's so fantastic. Well, what can you tell us about the other performance aspects? I had seen that there will be acrobatic acts.
Yeah, yes. So much like Mizuki and his team of incredible creatives, we also work with Marilyn Chen and Liquid Sky, who's been a longtime collaborator of art on the Atlanta Beltline. And they're bringing an incredible Cirque day party to the Beltline, as well as we'll have a Novoa dance there and Jeremy Muller, who are bringing a beautiful enmeshment of technology and music and movement to our Friday events. And so we're very excited to have, you know, those performance artists there. And we'll have M3, which is Atlanta's boy band, will also be performing. So it'll be a full day of really beautiful immersive experiences that Friday as well. And then of course Sunday, we can't miss the Big Tiggers Beltline Bike Fest, which is incredibly important, and everybody should make time to come out there and participate in this incredible event that he's worked with us on for the last several months to really bring his passion of biking and health to the youth of Atlanta.
I want to ask you more about the Bike Fest in just a sec, but I got to circle back. I am not familiar with M3. You called them Atlanta's boy band?
Yes, these are
Tell me more.
You know, if you've been on the East Side Trail in the last several months, you've probably seen them out there. They're these incredible young men who are heavily influenced by Motown and rhythm and blues. And they are brothers and they sing in beautiful harmony. And if you love throwbacks, they are definitely the band for you. So they remind me a little bit of the Temptations. They are really fun to watch and they have a really bright future ahead of them.
Good music.
I got your theme where you said you were checking on me. We broke up, you're alone. You were sitting there thinking of me. I got your message where you were texting my brothers about me. I guess I've been a little busy.
So I want folks to come out and, you know, watch them perform and encourage them. And maybe they'll be you know, get your signatures now, because one day when they're famous, it might be worth something.
I love that. I love that. Well, let's circle back to Big Tigger's Bike Fest. Tell us more about that.
So Big Tigger came to us and had this incredible idea about bringing his passion to the corridor and giving away bicycles to kids so he could share that passion of health and wellness and well-being and connectivity on the Beltline that he fell in love with over the course of the pandemic. And he said that this is where we got to do it. We got to do it on the Beltline. And we are so thrilled to be collaborating with him and his team to bring it to Westside Park on Sunday. He'll be giving away bikes to Atlanta Public Schools kids. There was a call that went out and a roster. So those bikes are getting picked up pretty quickly. And so, you know, if you are also into music and food and a celebration of wellness on the West End, please come out, because it'll be a beautiful day to celebrate the youth of the city and how powerful these incredible men are who are bringing that joy to our communities and giving back. And so it's really a beautiful, it'll be a beautiful event.
Before I let you go, is there anything else that we should know ahead of time before heading out to the event?
Oh, well, I think that there'll definitely be, you know, there'll be food and snacks and all that good stuff there. But, you know, bring your favorites, bring a picnic basket or your favorite, you know, blanket and chair and sunscreen, you know, and come out for the day and just come spend the weekend with us.
Right. I wanted to shout out two artists or two groups that I failed to mention, DJ Ear Doctor and Egbe Shekere, who will be on hand for No Tables, No Chairs. And for the day, I would say bring your dancing shoes and stay hydrated.
Those are honestly some of my best pieces of advice for life in general. Stay hydrated and wear your sunscreen. Perfect. Perfect. Thank you guys so much for sharing your time with us. We really look forward to the event.
Thanks so much. Have a wonderful day.
Atlanta Beltline Arts and Culture Program Manager Miranda Kyle and musician Mosiki Scale speaking with City Light Senior Producer Kim Drobes. More information about the Beltline After Dark Festival is on our website, wabe.org/citylights. Coming up, makeup artist Carol Rashid discusses the writer's strike on our series Speaking of Yollywood. Amplifying Atlanta, this is 90.1 WABE. This is City Lights on WABE. I'm Lois Wrights. It's great to have you along. It's time now for our series Speaking of Yollywood, where we highlight the many local film and television professionals that keep the Atlanta industry thriving.
My name is Carol Rashid, and I am a television and film makeup artist. I've worked in the business for over 3 decades. A typical day for me is to start at about 4:30 a.m. in the morning, sometimes on location, sometimes not. And I'm there usually before everybody gets there and there until after everybody leaves, the regular crew-wise. I have my actress come in, I prepare for my actress, I set up my station, pull out everything that I'm gonna use for that particular actress on that day, depending on what the scene is, and I'm just prepared. I started my television and film career in 1989, working for Walt Disney World. That's where I got my first opportunity to really find out about makeup artistry for the film and television industry. It was really around the time when Disney actually built the MGM Studios on property there. So I had an opportunity to work on many shows at Disney, and I, you know, did that for a couple of years and went on over to Nickelodeon and headed that up, and the rest is history, as they say. The favorite part of my job as a makeup artist is really working with the actors and developing a character to help them get into the character. You know, makeup plays a huge part in that. So I really enjoyed that aspect of working as a makeup artist for TV and film. The hardest part of my job as a makeup artist is really trying to have a work-life balance. As many are aware that work within the industry, we're working anywhere between 12, 14, 16 hours a day. And so finding a work-life balance to spend time with your family and your friends and do other things outside of the industry, that's the most challenging thing in the business that I've found, is really being able to spend time with your family and friends. One of the misconceptions about working as a makeup artist is that it's glamorous. You have fun, but let me tell you something, it is hard work. You're working in all kind of elements, outside in the snow and the rain sometimes. You know, you start earlier than everybody. Generally, we get pre-calls 2 to 3 hours before anybody else is there. And you're usually there until the end if your actors are working, you know. So those are some of the misconceptions that I want to share with people, is that it is hard work. And it is a thing where you have to constantly educate yourself and stay up on what the trends are, you know, understand so many aspects of working as a makeup artist. Is people think that it's real easy now because of Instagram, you know, everything is instant, and it's just not really realistic to what we do within the television and film industry. So I think that's one of the misconceptions that I'd like to dispel, is that it's not easy. One of my favorite movies to work on was The Color Purple, which is not even out as of yet. I believe it's coming out on December the 25th, 2023. You know, the reason that I enjoyed working on The Color Purple is because it is an iconic movie. You know, people know the characters. You know, the book was very popular back in the day when it came out. And I think that it really shows the strength of women. That movie. So I really just thoroughly enjoyed, you know, department heading that and just working on it. I also love doing game shows. It's one of my favorite things, to be in front of a live audience and working with, you know, and people getting an opportunity to see what goes on behind the scenes. I always felt that that was always fun for me. Well, the writer's strike has happened again. I was around when the writer's strike happened. I believe it was in 2009 or 2007. I don't remember the exact time. You know, the thing that I learned from the writer's strike back then was to save your money. You know, working as a freelancer is really important to save while you're working. So we have the writer's strike now. Next, we're probably going to have the DGA strike and also the actor's strike, I think, which their contract ends June 30th. So, you know, the best advice that I can always give, you know, specifically to people that are working in the industry, is that when you work, save your money, you know, at least 10% of your earnings, if you can, or put back, save whatever you can, because it's a strike now, and trust and believe, it's probably going to be another strike in the future. So it's important to save while you're working.
Makeup artist Carol Rashid, and our series Speaking of Yollywood. More information about Rashid's work, as well as our entire Speaking Of series, is on our website, wabe.org/citylight. I'm sad to say that John Weatherford died last Friday. He was a veteran news reporter, broadcast producer for WAGA-TV. He founded Weatherford Communications, and John was chief operating officer of our organization from 2004 to 2015. For many years before he was senior VP here, John was a loyal listener to WABE, which is how we met. He adored music, collecting thousands of recordings on vinyl and CD. He also collected microphones. Among the highlights of his career was producing a television special about Robert Shaw's conducting the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra and Chorus in Berlin during the 1980s. Throughout his years as Public Broadcasting Atlanta's chief operating officer, John was a most dedicated leader. He gave an incredible amount of time to our organization and enjoyed every aspect of it. My deepest sympathy goes out to John Weatherford's wife, Michelle, and to his children and grandchildren. He was extraordinary in his devotion. There will be a memorial service for John Weatherford on Saturday, June 3rd, at 2 p.m. at Oak Grove United Methodist Church. You've been listening to City Lights, our daily exploration of arts and culture. Catch an encore broadcast tonight at 9. And please note that starting next week, our encore broadcast moves to 8 p.m. Tomorrow at 11 a.m., we'll hear about the art of Dr. Seuss on view at the Ann Jackson Gallery in Roswell. If you missed part of today's show, like our earlier story about the Out Down South exhibition at the National Center for Civil and Human Rights, you could catch up through our podcast or on our website, wabe.org/citylights. There you'll find a complete archive of our stories, so you can listen to City Lights on your schedule. City Lights senior producer is Kim Droves. Our producers are Summer Evans and Janine Etter, and our engineer is Shelley Canavy. I'm your host, Lois Reitzes. Do connect with City Lights on social media. We're at WABE City Lights on both Facebook and Instagram. And you can follow me on Twitter at LOISREITZES. Thanks for listening to WABE Atlanta.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of mysteries. Are ghosts real? Is that yogurt expired? Hey, the unknown can be scary. But when you donate to WABE, you know where your money is going. Your gift supports the journalism that keeps you informed and the programs that pull back the curtain on complicated stories. Help us make the world less mysterious. Become a member now. Go online to wabe.org/donate, and thanks.